Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? This is the show, my show, the Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Express. 3 to 5 Eastern Time weekdays here, libertyexpressradio.com. We're also on Daily Paul Radio, and they play the reruns over at Liberty Radio Network still to this day. Isn't that great? We're on anomalyradio.com, of course. And who knows what else? I don't know. Anyway. If you missed it, you could have missed it. But I got a KPFK show on 90.7 FM in LA. Huh, that's weird. And what goes on there is, yeah, it's an interview show. Looks like this one. Anyway, you may have missed it, but there's a Gareth Porter interview. It's not up in the archives yet at scotthorton.org, but it will be. It actually is in the archives at kpfk.org if you want to look there. They've got the archive of the show. Great interview of Gareth Porter from Saturday about the situation in Iraq and Iran and American foreign policy toward Iraq and Iran and Syria, etc. So that's a good one for you. And we'll have one like that today with Patrick Coburn, the great Patrick Coburn. I don't think there's a white man anyway who knows more about what the hell goes on over there than him. He's the best reporter. He's an Irish guy. There's no reason that I prefer his ethnicity to another reporter's ethnicity. I'm saying there must be some Arabs who are better reporters than him on all these subjects. I just don't know them. His name is actually easier to say, even with all the silent letters and everything. whatever. Anyway, Patrick Coburn, he'll be on the show to talk about the mess. Oh, the mess. In the Middle East. That should be good. And then I got a few invites out. Seems like 2014 is getting off to kind of a slow start. Are you picking up that vibe? For example, I had to miss the show last Thursday and Friday. I wanted to be here. I had shows prepared, but I had to cancel because things came up. But I'm not the only one. I get the idea a lot of people are calling in hangover today. Still working, getting over that transition. The odometer effect. As the calendar year flips over. Speaking of which, you've got to admit, it's kind of a trip that it's 2014 already, right? Doesn't that kind of freak you out? It's almost the middle of the next decade already. My brain's still stuck in the last one. Maybe the one before that. Anyway, I'm trying to adjust to the idea. I've already written the date wrong a few times. I'm going to keep writing it wrong for a while, I'm sure. But anyway. It's so easy for me to remember. It seems like it was just yesterday that the year 2000 was this ominous milestone of the future. Not ominous, like in a scary sense. That's not the right word. It was this huge freaking thing, man. The year 2000. I used to watch a show on the Discovery Channel called Beyond 2000. What will it be like in the mysterious high-tech, I think is part of the understanding there too. New era. The brave new future. Beyond 2000. How's it gonna be? And now here already, that was 14 years ago? I'd have to argue we as a society, led by our government, our meaning it owns us, got the century off on the wrong foot here really bad. Didn't have to either. But you know what? You listen to Richard Pearl and do what he says you ought to do, things aren't going to work out very well for you. Let that be a lesson. To not do what Richard Pearl would have you do. And things might work out a little better. All right. Yellen, real quick. I saw the hearing, a little bit of the hearing this morning with Yellen, who is to be confirmed. She's going to be confirmed. Now, wasn't there going to be a little thing about Rand Paul was pushing for an audit of some kind and was going to hold up her nomination or try to? I don't know whatever happened with that. But anyway, she'll be confirmed. She'll be the new chair of the Fed. And she and Stanley Fisher, the new dual citizen American Israeli, the last head of their central bank, is going to now come and be her deputy at the American Federal Reserve. And they will agree to inflate more. And I didn't get to watch all the hearing this morning, but basically what it was about was, you think we should inflate more? You think you should inflate more? Yeah. Do you think interest rates should stay low? Yeah. Are you going to raise them? No. Are you going to keep buying government debt and bad debts of bankers who made bad bets during the bubble? Yes. Forever? Uh-huh. And you're going to keep printing money? That's right. And that's an exact transcript of the hearing, actually. Okay, that's a not very rough paraphrase of what happened this morning on C-SPAN. And so, well, it was early this afternoon, I guess. And so the lesson is this. Now, some people, and I think maybe some of them took it back, too. You might have heard from the people who predicted the bubble best, some squawking about massive price inflation across the board due to the insane amount of new currency and new credit being created by the state to be loaned out by the banks. Now, I have a theory, and this isn't my specialty, but I have a theory that Ron Paul especially got through to Ben Bernanke, that there can be real problems brought about by inflation. Remember the 70s. Remember Argentina. So even if the dollar doesn't break, still inflation would be really bad. And so I think Ron Paul was basically the angel on Ben Bernanke's shoulder. And Ben Bernanke came up with the idea, well, I'll create enough money to make all the banks whole on all their bad bets, but I'll pay them to keep all their money at the Federal Reserve. So their books will be balanced and whatever, but they won't loan the money out. And of course, in a deflationary period where bad debts and bad businesses are being liquidated all over the place still, and marginal ones, there's no real good reason for the banks to prefer to loan that money out when they have a sure thing. You know, that's risky to take on a new business. Most new small businesses fail in the first 2 years, of course, right? Everybody knows that. So why take the risk when, if you're a bank, when you can just keep the money at the Fed? And so that's helped to tame the widespread inflation. On the other hand, in some places, the housing prices are back at their record highs from 2006 and 7. And on the other hand, the stock market is way out ahead of the rest of society. And on the other hand, there is huge inflation in some sectors of the economy. We call them bubbles. And what that means is, well, it's a, I don't know if maybe an economist, the Austrians or anybody else would hit me with a stick for saying it this way, because I'm not the master of all their jargon and whatever, but it's a false price. Basically, it's a bad signal being sent about the price of money, about how much wealth is laying around waiting to be invested in something. And when you send those bad signals, what happens is you get deformations in the economy. And when you have those deformations, what happens is they get corrected, causing severe pain for everybody who's stuck in the misinvestment, the malinvestment, they call it, the bad investment based on the bad price. In other words, central government malpractice. Regardless of all the corruption involved, and just think of it, a license to print money. If you're Citigroup, you can just create money because the government says you can. But regardless of all of that, the government attempt to rig the value of the dollar only causes disruptions and deformations, and that's what's the boom and the bust. in that so-called business cycle. It's not the business cycle. It's the government currency cycle. And I don't know how high it's going to go before it all comes crashing down, but it's going to. And the best of the people who predicted it the most accurately last time around are saying the same thing again. People like Peter Schiff, the guys over at Mises.org. So look out. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Changed up the clock a little bit so that I'm fitting right with Liberty Express and how the show's supposed to go. So I'm going to have to get used to that. I might screw up and skip some breaks from time to time, although I'm going to try not to. How about that? My plan will be to not screw up and miss breaks. All right. So anyway, lots to cover. I got, again, a few more invites out, so I'm still waiting to hear back, but definitely going to have Patrick Cobert on to talk about what's going on in Iraq and Syria especially. But man, he wrote some really great stuff. I'll just go ahead and recommend them to you now so you can get to Googling. A Long Ferment in the Middle East is one. Its subhead is The Hazards of Revolution. The Hazards of Revolution by Patrick Cobert. And then the other one is about Sunni monarchs back. What the? I don't know what just happened there. Sunni monarchs back YouTube hate preachers. Monarchs. That was weird. Mozilla just changed my tab to something else and won't let me go back either. Sunni monarchs, YouTube, hate, something like that. That'll Google it right up. There we go. It's at independent.org. I mean, what the hell? Independent.co.uk. Independent.org is something entirely different. Independent.co.uk and also at uns.com. Sunni monarchs back YouTube hate preachers. Anti-Shia propaganda threatens a sectarian civil war which will engulf the entire Muslim world. And you know, I don't even think Coburn's headline writers really engage in much hyperbole. That's pretty much what the article says. Well, it's not a definite future, but it's a very possible one. And a scary one. A bad one. Anyway, so, stay tuned. Patrick Cobert coming up on the show. Now, a little bit of gloating. Liz Cheney has had to withdraw from her primary challenge against Senator, is it Mike Enzi? I forget his first name. I think it's Mike. Anyway, doesn't matter. I stand corrected. I predicted that Enzi would step down to go and spend time with his family. Because otherwise he would be living with a mark on his head. And so, you know, who wants to die in a suspicious single car accident? Who wants to get killed by the Cheneys? Not me. Can you imagine? You're a sitting senator and all of a sudden Dick Cheney's daughter starts running against you. Oh, man. What do I do? Start wearing a bulletproof ski mask? Somebody cover me in Kevlar. I'm afraid of these people. But he stuck with it. He did not go and step down to spend time with his family. And the polls said that the people of Wyoming, why, they just don't like Liz Cheney. Now, I wonder why that is. Certainly, it's nothing about her family or her personality. But man, what a relief. I gotta tell you. Now, of course, the Cheneys could still have this guy whacked, and the governor could appoint her in his place. She's definitely the official runner-up now just for throwing her hat in there at all, right? So he should not stop wearing a bulletproof vest now, you know? But listen, I mean, I'm here to tell you, I think that Liz Cheney, if she actually made it to senator, she would be four or five times as deadly as Hillary Clinton. That's what she is. She's like Hillary Clinton to the nth power. Mean. That Liz Cheney. Oh, and so dishonest. Oh, and she brings such confidence to her dishonesty. Just like her father. Look, clearly, and then lie about why people ought to be killed. Oh, no thank you. We will happily do without you. And listen, I was saying to my friend last night about that, and he was going, come on, Scott Horton. The Senate doesn't mean anything anyway. It's the executive branch and the president. They rule the state. The Senate is just there for show. Come on. Okay, you're right, but still. I'm still right, too, that she would be a really bad senator. And as a debating society, that would be like putting Satan's right-hand minion in power there to make the Empire's case on everything. To be horrible on everything. Including torturing people to death. You know? So, I would rather have a debating society where the worst one of them is Chuck Schumer, who's a clown. Who's a ridiculous clown. Right? Are you with me? So, now, I don't know exactly what they meant, but they say there was a clash at Sunday dinner or Christmas dinner or something there in the Cheney household, implying perhaps that this was a fight between her and her sister about her sister's lesbianism and gay marriage to her partner. Isn't she married? I think she's married. Mary Cheney. Imagine that. They name her Mary and she got married, huh? Derp. So, Liz Cheney thought that she would, ingratiate herself real good with the people of Wyoming by betraying her sister and denouncing her sister and the way she lives and the idea that she would want to be married to her life partner. And so the people of Wyoming were torn. Well, geez, we don't particularly like lesbians or gay marriage, but we do like family, and we're not much into throwing our parents and siblings under the bus publicly for political gain. Who the hell does that? What decent person could witness such a thing and not think, wow, you're a terrible person, Liz Cheney. You're disgusting, Liz Cheney. You're like Hillary Clinton, only even more dishonest and more deadly. And we don't like you at all. And so, no, you can't have power. I don't know. It's a little something. It's just a little something. You get to live in a world where Liz Cheney won't be a senator, at least not yet. For a little while. We get to continue on sans Senator Cheney. And she's mean. You just go look her up on YouTube. She's wrong. She's horrible. Bad on torture, bad on every war, bad on every false accusation against any of America's empire's so-called adversaries. So, she has withdrawn from the race. That's it. Booyah. Ha ha. All right, good. And then my friend wanted me to mention that it's Bush, George H.W. Bush and Barbara Bush's wedding anniversary today. I'm not sure ended up on the Republican calendar mailing list there, or exactly what's going on with that. But so he asked for a rant, a chaos-style rant about Bush Sr. and Barbara Bush. So I'll start with Barbara Bush. Barbara Bush once said, and this is almost exact, that why should I have to hear about casualties, dead and wounded soldiers? I mean, it's not relevant. That's the exact quote. It's not relevant. So why would I waste my beautiful mind? It's very beautiful, her mind, on something negative like that. Like the people who die, the Americans who die fighting the wars that her husband and her son get them into based on this lie or the other. I mean, the nerve. How would you like hearing that? George W. Bush sends your son off to die on a fool's errand, and then you got to hear his mom talk about, so? Man, those Bushes. And then, more to the point, and much more substantively, everything wrong in the world right now is the fault of George H.W. Bush. Because of what he did at the end of the Cold War. Instead of abolishing NATO, calling off the empire, reinstituting as much of the constitutional limitations on the power of the government and really the form of it that it describes. Instead of being a normal country in a normal time, like even Jean Kirkpatrick, the former neocon at that point, I guess. Once she said that, she was kicked right out of the club. But anyway, he said, nope, we're going to expand NATO all the way to Russia's door. We're going to go to war in the Middle East and occupy it and own it forever. And expand the empire bases throughout the entire world. We're not coming home from Japan. We're not coming home from Korea. And we're making as many inroads as we can straight into the Caspian Basin. What? Damned imperialists. And that's what got us into this mess. Because, of course, it was the war in Iraq and the permanent occupation of Saudi Arabia in order to blockade and bomb Iraq throughout the Bush Sr. and Clinton years that got us attacked and created the excuse for the next round of intervention under Bush's son. Which is why so many people around the world are being violently killed to this day. And more of that when we get back right after this. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I still ain't done, but I got some more of Goliath Red over the holiday break. By the way, again, I hope you did have a good one. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's and all that stuff. I like the holidays, man. I know some people, though. I do. Anyway. Got some more Goliath Red. So I promise soon I'll have Max on to talk about that. Max Blumenthal. And you know it's good just from who's going after him for writing the dang thing. Am I right? You seen all the smears? In the Jerusalem Post, I talked about this before on the show, so I'll just mention it briefly. In the Jerusalem Post, they smear Max Blumenthal as an anti-Semite. Really? That's the best you've got? Come on. The kid's name is Blumenthal. He's a self-hating Jew. Well, I don't know. He seems to have just fine self-esteem all the times I ever talk to him. Are you sure that the problem is he doesn't think too much of himself? How can he hate himself and think too much of himself at the same time? Oh, maybe he is just being a liberal, you know, at its very root, meaning he believes that people have rights. And I mean, at its very root, never mind the fact that he is kind of a socialist and a modern day liberal anyway, but still, at the very root of that is that, hey, human lives have value, jerk, so back off. And so, apparently, that overrides the idea that I don't think anybody ever proved the case for this or anything, that or even really tried, that one's, ethnic or religious grouping ought to determine that outsiders are enemies to be killed. I mean, people argue that a lot, but I don't think anybody ever argued that it's legit, you know? Anyway, when I read Max Blumenthal, what I read is, you know, what you could call run-of-the-mill American Jeffersonianism, right? In terms of just, you know, valuing the rights of man. That's all. And he's just pointing out how the Israeli government, well, they just go around violating the rights of men all day and night and lie. And so he writes about it. It's good work. And the fact that nobody can really come up with any criticism of him other than, well, I don't like the way you made me feel, which is the essence of, say, for example, Eric Alterman's articles. He wrote 9 different pieces. Can you believe it? Eric Alterman at The Nation magazine, the liberal centrist magazine, which they published the book. But Eric Alterman wrote 9 articles attacking Max Blumenthal, in which he admits that, well, the book is correct on the facts. Oh, okay. So, is the door locked or can I leave your 2 minutes 8 now? What the hell is that about? Well, you know, Max Blumenthal, I can't really dispute the things that he says, but I dispute that he should say the things that he says. Yeah, great argument. Goodness gracious. Moving on to Israel-Palestine. That's why I want to talk about Max Blumenthal there for a minute. Here's a bunch of things in no particular order about Israel-Palestine. Most Israelis and Palestinians support a two-state solution. That's according to a study by Hebrew University, as reported in the Times of Israel, which is a right-wing site in Israel, timesofisrael.com. So this isn't, you know, wishful thinking on the part of the editors or anything like that. Most Israelis, Palestinians support two-state solution. Hebrew University study shows many on both sides eager to achieve peace, but wary of opposing parties' true aim. Well, I think that's really important to note. I mean, I don't know who should be surprised at all that Palestinians want independence, but the fact that most Israelis, what this means is most Israelis want the settlers out and to give up the West Bank. That's what this means. And for that matter, the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. And let that be a Palestinian country rather than just permanently occupied territory. Most Israeli Jews want that, or at least most Israelis, but 4/5 of Israeli citizens are Jews, so, still a majority. 63% of Israelis, it says in the poll. So, that's really important, that the government of the Israeli state, you know, the leaders of the Israeli state, they do what they want, which is not necessarily what the people of Israel want. Never mind the people of occupied territories who don't get a say in what the Israeli government does. They're taxed, but not represented, so to speak. And then this is huge. I don't know the background of this. I was hoping to get Phil Weiss on the show to talk a little bit about this from his blog. It's by Allison Degger. U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv shuts down after tens of thousands of African asylum seekers protest. I don't know how they were free to get there. I thought they were mostly in concentration camps. I guess this is the ones that weren't in concentration camps. Israeli onlookers jeered at the marchers, shouting, "Go home and go back to Africa." And this is something I think is so important for Americans to understand, that the parts of American history that most of us, at least, the super-duper majority of us, consider shameful and, in fact, are proud that our society eventually overcame them, like slavery and like civil rights. I'm not saying racism is dead, but Jim Crow official state-mandated segregation is illegal in this country. And we want it that way. And we're proud that somebody finally got their act together and made it that way. But in Israel, really what it is it's white supremacy. It's a bunch of European colonialists, or not really colonialists, but settlers. And yes, there are Sephardic Jews and all that there too, but most of them are Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe, and the children of Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe. And as Netanyahu's aide said just a few months back, 3-4 months ago, one of Netanyahu's ministers said, in regards to African refugees, Israel is for the white man. What they need to understand is Israel is for the white man, and they need to go home. And so, in other words, Israel, with our money, $3.5 billion plus a year, and there's military and civilian aid and loans and guarantees and all kinds of things. You add it all up, it's probably more like $5 billion a year to Israel that we pay them so that they can afford to be a Jim Crow society. And at the same time, they can afford a full socialized healthcare and education system for Israeli Jews anyway. So we're paying for socialism, we're paying for Jim Crow institutionalized racism and bigotry, and creating enemies for ourselves, and getting what out of it? Somebody, I asked this over and over, well, a few times over again anyway, on the show and on Twitter and on Facebook. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Somebody tell me anything that Israel has ever done for the United States. I mean, in fact, even name one real good piece of intelligence that they passed on. And never mind for anything you could possibly come up with, I got 100 times that they screwed us. But I can't even think of anything that America gets in return for our government's devotion to their government and its horrible policies than enemies. And I don't think that counts. So don't email me saying, "I know enemies." No, I already said that. That doesn't count. I mean something positive. I mean, okay, pretend for a minute that they would cover this on the nightly news. Don't you think that this is a big deal? Tens of thousands of Africans shut down the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv. Such is the size of their massive protest. Because they're seeking asylum in Israel and are being denied. "Go back to Africa," the Israelis shout at them. Man. All right. Oh, and all right. So anyway, I told you these are in no particular order. Sorry. Likud sources claim the prime minister is ready to negotiate on the basis of pre-1967 lines. Now, don't believe that. I don't believe that, that Netanyahu is prepared to really give up the West Bank. And then there's this great article. I don't know if I have it here, but there's a great article somewhere about how the Jordan Valley is this giant red herring. And how the Israelis are intent on keeping it occupied, not because they need it for strategic reasons. And all of the excuses are really, well debunked. I mean, just look at the fact that, you know, just like in the clean break strategy, America got rid of Saddam Hussein for them. They face no land threat to the east whatsoever. Certainly not Jordan, even if there was a revolution there. There's no army for them to take over and march. They don't have a security problem. And in fact, if they had a permanent garrison, they argue in there, if they had a permanent garrison in the Jordan Valley, they wouldn't be the ones to defend from an attack anyway. It would be new divisions would be brought in to do the fighting at that point anyway, because that's the way their military's set up or whatever. I don't know. So anyway, there is no tactical, strategic, military interest in occupying the Jordan Valley. No, it's just about keeping the Palestinians surrounded. It's just about making sure that whatever is ever called a state there isn't really one. That's the Jordan Valley red herring. I'm sorry, I forgot who wrote that article. Maybe, is it this one at Haaretz? No. And then, this is really important too. Avigdor Lieberman is a secular Russian Jew, and he's the foreign minister. And so he doesn't have a religious interest in Judea and Samaria and owning them forever. And he's saying, strategically speaking, forget Greater Israel. Go ahead, Avigdor Lieberman says. Give up the West Bank. But then we ought to do land swaps where all the settlements stay, or at least most of them stay, only Israeli territory has expanded them, and all the Israeli Arabs, Israeli citizen Arabs, would be kicked out and would have to go live in Palestine, or at least would have to live under the Palestinian Authority, would be exiled from Israel. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And website's getting better and better all the time. My buddy Dave has been doing a great job fixing up the website. There's a new category of documentaries under videos at the top. And it's basically it's every documentary that I can think of that I would recommend to you. I've put up there, and I've got them sort of kind of roughly categorized by topic there. Iraq and Afghanistan, torture, Guantanamo, that kind of stuff. And then Vietnam and World War stuff from back in previous era. Yeah. Real good stuff there. And there's a chat room too, scotthorton.org/chat. And I've gotten some pretty good feedback from this. I can't say it's made much money yet, but the feedback is people really like the idea of this Amazon thing where if you just go to scotthorton.org and click the Amazon link before you go buy stuff from Amazon, then I get a little bit of a kickback from their end of the deal, not yours. And you can just go to scotthorton.org/Amazon and it'll forward you on there. And then anything that you get at Amazon after that, it'll give you, you know, put a cookie on there for you or whatever. So, anything that you get there after that, I'll get a little bit of a kickback from it. And especially if you're one of these people, a friend of the show emailed and said that, his wife just does nothing but buy stuff on Amazon all day. Poor guy. And anyway, so she's under instructions now, as long as she's doing that to him. Stop by scotthorton.org first. So that's nice. Especially those of you with wives who are addicted to shopping at amazon.com, direct them to scotthorton.org. That sounds like a good moneymaker there. All right, anyway. So thanks a lot for helping support the show. That's a good way to help support. And again, it doesn't raise your price at all. It takes it from Amazon's end of the exchange there. So you know what? 32 cents here and 69 cents there. Pretty soon you're talking about a little bit of money. All right. Not bad. Help pay the bills. All right. So I don't want to waste time talking about Syria and Iraq for you now because Patrick Coburn is fixing to be on the show. And that's what he's going to talk about. So we'll leave that to him. Well, all right. You know what? I may talk about Egypt, but I may get to that with Patrick. So let me go ahead, first of all, and cover a little bit of NSA stuff for you here. Wait, did I say everything I want to say about Israel-Palestine today? Because, you know, there's a lot of that. Well, I mean, I was interrupted by the break when I was talking about the Lieberman plan to do land swaps. And who knows? You know what? Here's what you need to know about the Israel-Palestine peace process. It doesn't mean a thing. The leadership of the Palestinian side was picked by the Americans and the Israelis anyway. Mahmoud Abbas, and he doesn't have any authority, really. And he ain't willing to try hard. And the Israelis, Benjamin Netanyahu and his coalition, they're not going to give up the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. They have things how they like them. Why change it? The Americans are going to keep paying them no matter what. They've got the children of the Gaza Strip penned in their concentration camp there under complete siege. And in the West Bank, they just continually carve it up, add new settlements, establish facts on the ground like, hey, we built a city here, so it's tough for you. And then eventually, I don't know, I guess, I'm trying to remember, man, where was it that I read? Help me out, chat room, guys, because I'm about to say something controversial without a footnote. Somebody help me find where I read that during the first Gulf War, Benjamin Netanyahu urged the government, I think it was Netanyahu, but somebody, I'm pretty sure it was Netanyahu, was urging the government to take advantage of the first Gulf War as cover and go ahead and, you know, Cherokee-style force march, Nakba-style force march the Palestinians out of the West Bank. I guess into the Jordan River if they can swim or, you know, maybe, if they're lucky. And now maybe it was during the fall of the Soviet Union, because one of my neurons is saying, no, dummy, it wasn't during the first Gulf War. It was during the fall of the Soviet Union. And the thinking was that, hey, Soviet Union's falling, so nobody's paying attention to us. Let's force march all the Palestinians out of the West Bank. Well, anyway, I'm damn sure it was either the first Gulf War or the fall of the Soviet Union a year before that. Or a year after that, really. And I'm pretty sure it was Netanyahu. But anyway, so that's, at least I admit when I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But I'm pretty damn sure it was Netanyahu. It was somebody important over there. And that's their policy eventually, is to just take the West Bank. And they call it Sumeria, and that means belongs to us, not you. And it also means, oh, if you live here, tough. That's their policy. That's the policy that the Americans are paying for. Anyway, I sure hope somebody in the chat room can Google quick and help me out with a footnote on that, because I'm way out on a limb, man. I'm way out on a limb. I was just reading it recently, you know. My problem is I read too much. Now, most of the time I can picture the page that I saw the thing that I was thinking of. So I go, oh, that was in Foreign Policy, I'm pretty sure. Or somewhere. With this half-baked recall right here, not so much. Frustratingly vague. All right, well, you guys aren't going to Google it for me. I guess I'll have to Google it. Let's see if I can find it. It makes terrible radio, but I don't care about that for some reason. I'll do it anyway. Let's see. Netanyahu wanted cleanse West Bank. First Gulf War. Well, it would have been nice if it had come right up. How about fall Soviet Union? Yeah, I know. It's the best radio you ever heard. Man, where was that? I was reading that. Boy, it sure would help if I could kind of recall my source here or something, doesn't it? Wouldn't it? And I mean, I don't even know if they use the word ethnic cleansing or whatever. That's just a guess, you know? I don't know. Somebody's looking for me there. Wish I had better keywords for you. Ron Paul Institute, somebody says. Jennifer Rubin, we won the Iraq War. Oh, good. Now, this isn't about what we're talking about, though, right? This is something else. Or is that in there? Nah, that's from today. So that's not it. All right, anyway. Point being, the peace process is a giant fraud. And I don't know how hard John Kerry is really pushing to make this thing happen. I will remind you what Andrew Coburn said on the show, that Obama and Kerry don't like each other. And Obama is not willing to let Kerry have the authority to really do what he has to do to solve the Palestinian problem, which would be to threaten to withhold aid to Israel. But he won't do that. Obama won't do that because he doesn't like Kerry, and he'll be damned if John Kerry, rather than Barack Obama, is going to be the one to solve the Israel-Palestine thing. And if Obama can't be the one to solve it, then nobody's going to solve it. And that sounds about right to me. Damned Democrats. And so where Kerry, if he could just say, you know what, that's it, Israel, we're cutting you off. No more daily haul of National Security Agency intel, and no more money for you. Until you pack up the settlers and get them out of the West Bank and give up the West Bank. Right now. And so since he doesn't have that authority, Obama won't give him that authority. Boy, Congress would freak, wouldn't they? But anyway, so that's it. Facts on the ground. They'll just continue to expand settlements. 10,000 here and 10,000 there. And they'll just continue arresting and torturing Palestinians a few at a time until they're all gone, I guess. I don't know. All right, when we get back... Oh, man, wasn't I going to talk about the NSA? Snowden never took an oath to keep secrets. He took an oath to the Constitution. He simply agreed to keep secrets. So, which outweighs which? How about that? Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is the website. You can find all the interview archives and the whole show archives and the blog and all the rest of it there. ScottHorton.org. You can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right, our guest on the show today is the great Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, and author of quite a few books. The latest is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and The Future of Iraq. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Great.
Good. I appreciate you joining us on the show today. The Anbar province in Iraq, the predominantly Sunni Anbar province, it looks like there's a war on for control of the province, and they say that Fallujah and Ramadi are both, at least nominally, under control of the Islamic State of Iraq. Can you tell us what you know about the situation there?
I mean, there is a war on. It's a complicated civil war. What's really extraordinary is that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which now operates under the umbrella of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which was meant to be out of business 3 years ago, or very nearly so, is holding Fallujah, which is only 40 miles west of Baghdad, and had for a time held the center of Ramadi, which is the main city of Anbar province. Anbar province is actually enormous. It makes up about a third of Iraq, so it's all of western Iraq. So this is a tremendous change that Al-Qaeda should be taking over areas this big.
And now, I guess, what about half a year ago, you reported and talked on the show about the fact that the basically Shiite army, or at least the army of the Shiite government of Nouri al-Maliki, had withdrawn from the Anbar province. I guess were throwing up their hands in, if not outright defeat, they just were giving up on the idea that they could really exercise monopoly control over that territory at that point. Is that about right?
Well, it's actually worse than that. I mean, they've seemed to have devised a mix of repression and conciliation that they get the worst of both worlds. That we saw that last year, that there was sort of concessions and so a nice talk, and then in April they attacked a protest camp in Hawija, which is near Kirkuk, and killed about 50 people. And we've seen the same sort of process really over the last 2 weeks. That we got an election coming up in April in Iraq, parliamentary election. That's going to decide the future of the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. If he gets a majority, he can run, have a third term. So he wants to look tough. He wants some successes. That seems to be what's behind all this. You know, things have got worse, mainly because of Syria. Syrian al-Qaeda fighters have been crossing over into Iraq. There's been a big upsurge in suicide bombing. A lot of the bombers are said to be foreign jihadi, foreign al-Qaeda supporters who've come into Syria, but actually end up by blowing themselves up in Iraq. The last couple of weeks, the army had an offensive. Then in one training camp, 24 officers got killed, including a divisional commander. Then they arrested a senior Sunni MP. They moved into the cities. Then they said they were moving out of the cities. Then Al-Qaeda moved in. Then now they say they're going to counterattack. So it's a great mess. But the government, basically what comes across is they're making it up by the day and not making it up very well.
Yeah, I read in Reuters that they're resorting to airstrikes, and that can't be good.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, they've been sort of attacking, showing pictures from drones and so forth. I don't think that they have much idea what they're attacking. Civilian casualties are likely to be high. There's likely to be even more feeling against the sort of hostility against the government. Mm-hmm. So I think, well, you know, what are we seeing here? We're seeing the government in Baghdad, the Shia government in Baghdad, really lose control of Sunni areas, which is west and sort of large part of northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. It's they're more and more confined just to areas held by the Shia. So it's been a disastrous couple of weeks for Nouri al-Maliki.
Well, now the hawks are saying that this is all Barack Obama's fault, of course, because if only the Americans had stayed, then none of this would have happened. This is the power vacuum being filled by the bad guys because the Democrats are cowards.
Yeah, it's sort of fantasy land, isn't it? I mean, the surge was always oversold. It's true that 2006 to 2007, Al-Qaeda overplayed its hand. It became very unpopular among Sunni Iraqis. They eventually, many of the tribes turned against them. But they were never entirely out of business. One of the reasons probably that they staged less attacks was they knew the U.S. was going. But I think that, you know, what Senator McCain has been saying, if they just continued the surge for a bit, everything would have been okay. This is a very naive, primitive view of Iraqi politics, really the sort of thing that got the U.S. into such trouble after the invasion of 2003.
Yeah, it seems like these guys should have to get an electroshock or something every time they say something like that and leave out the fact that there wasn't a single member of al-Qaeda in Iraq before the American invasion of 2003. In fact, you know, the way I remember, Zarqawi never was a member of al-Qaeda, didn't declare himself loyal to bin Laden and Zawahiri's goals until December, the end of December 2004, almost two full years into the war.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the reasons is that, and I think this is one of the great mistakes of the U.S. and Britain and elsewhere, is to think, aha, there's al-Qaeda, you know, which is closely organized, you know, it's like the Pentagon. And then it's very different from all these other jihadis and who are mostly, you know, have an ideology very similar to that of Saudi Arabia. In fact, they're all sort of pretty, they all have similarities. So I don't think, you know, killing bin Laden and so forth was ever going to have much effect. I think what's most extraordinary, and I, you know, it amazes me that governments have got away with it since 9/11, is at the time of 9/11, al-Qaeda was a very small organization. We have these enormous budgets for security organizations. We have all these security measures at airports. We have gigantic sums of money spent. You know, and what's the result after 12 years? Which is al-Qaeda is much bigger than it was then. You know, it controls a great swathe of territory in northern Iraq through northern Syria right over to the Mediterranean. The slogan of al-Qaeda is from, they say, you know, we control from Diyala, which is a province just to the northeast of Baghdad, to the Mediterranean. Now, you know, what were all these guys doing when this happened?
I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Patrick Coburn, and he's Middle East correspondent for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And here's a couple of articles I want y'all to look at. A Long Ferment in the Middle East, The Hazards of Revolution. That's at UNS.com as well as independent.co.uk. And then this one is at both sites as well. Sunni monarchs back YouTube hate preachers, about the maybe just now beginning, relatively speaking, civil war, Sunni-Shia civil war, or at least this phase of it. And really all, even the New York Times, Michael Gordon admitted in the New York Times that this whole thing was touched off by the American invasion and their war to install the Shiite United Iraqi Alliance in power in Baghdad, and really to help them and their Badr Brigade cleanse the city of Sunni Arabs, as they call it.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I think that... you know, how did all this happen? Well, you know, the surge was never as successful as anybody pretended that it was. You know, where the surge was, yes, it did do some things on the ground in Iraq, but a lot of it was directed at newsrooms in New York, you know, to get Iraq, prevent Iraq being the sort of main issue in the 2008 election. And, you know, I remember I was in Baghdad at the time and talking to, you know, reporters for, you know, often pretty good reporters for American networks. They said, we just can't get on air, you know, that somehow our bosses have been persuaded that this war is over and this war has been won.
We'll be right back after this. Just 1 minute.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. fact, there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Patrick Coburn from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And we're talking about Iraq and Syria. And, you know, as you said on the show before, as you've been saying on the show, and in your writing, the Sunni-based insurgency, for lack of a better term, in Syria, which a big contingent of that, a big part of that, are actually veterans of the Iraq War who've gone up to Syria to fight now, how that has re-energized the entire insurgency. They've been getting the short end of the stick from Nouri al-Maliki all this time, but now the revolution in Syria has got them thinking that it's time to go back to war. Enough of this ceasefire that started back in 07. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that it's happened. I mean, Maliki, it's a pretty dysfunctional government. December before last, at the end of 2012, peaceful protests started against the government. The Sunni, about 20% of the population, wanted better rights. They wanted to end persecution. They wanted an end to arbitrary arrests of their young men and women. And the government really didn't make any concessions or nothing adequate to the protesters. So what we've been having over the last year is sort of peaceful protest mutate into armed resistance. And the government always sort of underestimating what it was facing. And after Christmas, it closed down the main protest camp. And that was one of the things which ignited the present explosion.
And now, what kind of odds do you put on this thing? Does the Iraqi army have the ability to go in there and occupy ground, or is this a brand new era?
It has the ability to go in there and kill a lot of people. You know, it's about 900,000 people in the security forces in Iraq. But it's all, in many ways a way of sort of sopping up unemployment. A lot of these units sort of had never been trained. They don't have any exercises. I mean, they have guns, and people with guns can kill people. But since it's dominated by the Shia and they're facing the Sunni, I think a lot of people are going to die, are dying. But, you know, can they take it? Can they hold it? I doubt it, really. They don't have the manpower. I mean, they don't have the political sophistication to conciliate the Sunni. So I think they'll kill a lot of people, but that never got anybody very far in Iraq. I mean, you just you kill one guy, you know, his younger brother will replace him.
Well, then, would you say the same thing about...
So I think we're facing a very violent future.
Would you say the same thing about the Shiite Baathists in Syria, too, then? That, I mean, you've been saying all along that the rebels can't sack Damascus there, but then again, it looks more and more like the government of Damascus can't really take back some of the provinces that they've lost. Is that a mirror image going on there?
Yeah, that still seems to be the case, you know, that on the other hand, you know, the rebels now have divided between ISIS, the Iraqi Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is al-Qaeda, and the others, all the other rebel groups who are now fighting their sort of civil war within the civil war. So this must be good news for Assad and must mean that the rebels as a whole get weaker. But even so, it would be very difficult for Assad to win an all-out victory.
Well, And I guess, you know, we saw this in Iraq, too, and this is, I guess, why I'm a little bit surprised to see the level of fighting by al-Qaeda in Iraq, as well as in Syria, and Iraqi al-Qaeda in Syria all this time, is because they really wore out their welcome fast in Iraq. The people of Iraq, I mean, I guess most of what they called al-Qaeda in Iraq were foreigners who traveled there, at least, you know, a great percentage of them. And they were such jerks with all their suicide bombings of marketplaces and all that kind of thing. Instead of fighting the occupation, they got the Sunni Iraqis into a civil war with the Shiites, and which they lost, and all of this. And so everybody hated their guts because they're horrible. And that same kind of thing, it sounds like, is what's going on here in Syria as well, where the local Syrian Sunni Arabs are saying, hey, thanks, but no thanks for your help anymore, because we don't want to do what you say either.
Yeah, I mean, they're an incredible band, a bunch of people, you know. And, you know, one of the things that touched off the present one was that a well-respected militant from one of the other rebel groups was kidnapped by al-Qaeda and the next held for several days, and then his sort of badly tortured body turned up just about a week ago. And, you know, there were pictures all over the internet of what the guy looked at like, you know, a sort of smooth young man before he was picked up by al-Qaeda, and what he looked like a week later, you know, which he's basically been torn apart. So, you know, for reasons of anger at that, or just plain fear that they're going to be next, all the other non-al-Qaeda organizations are sort of rallying against them. But will they be able to wipe these people out? No, I don't think they will. I think it'll end up with some sort of agreement that al-Qaeda will be more careful in how it handles these people. But I don't think they're going to go out of business.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, it's almost silly to talk about this in a way to try to divide which groups are which there, but it seems like the Free Syrian Army, they've all hightailed it to Turkey or whatever, they're gone. And so this new group, they're calling it, at least in English and the American media, they're calling it the Islamic Front. And this is basically what everybody except the ISIL. And then does that include Jabhat al-Nusra, or are they fighting on the same side?
No, they have quite good relations with them. The thing about the Islamic Front is it's paid for by Saudi Arabia. That's the key fact. That's why these guys have come together. They're on the Saudi payroll. I mean, some organizations within it more than others, but effectively it's paid for by the Saudis. It's very jihadi, very Islamic. You know, it wants Sharia law. It's been involved in a number of massacres, but it's anti-Al-Qaeda, as well as being anti-Assad. But the key fact about it is that this is a proxy for Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, is that even a safe bet that they would stay loyal to Prince Bandar rather than switching to Ayman al-Zawahiri and switching to even the ISIL guys that they're supposed to be fighting now?
Well, you know, first of all, what these guys believe isn't that much different from Al-Qaeda. You know, they're deeply sectarian. They believe that all Shia are heretics and should be killed. Or similarly, they've killed a lot of Christians. You know, that they, ideologically, they're very much the same.
Okay, so now what about the war spreading to Lebanon?
Well, that's sort of happening, you know. I mean, we've had bombs and in Tripoli and in Beirut that the sort of local al-Qaeda commander was picked up and subsequently died. It's been mysterious about how he died, but he is dead. But, you know, it's clear you with these bombings and assassinations and so forth that Lebanon is being sucked into this. Now, how far will this go? You know, hope maybe it won't happen that fast. But, I mean, you know, that's the general direction. It won't happen that fast because the Lebanese have had 15 years of this. They're not eager to go back. I mean, 15 years of civil war, they're not eager to go back to it. Mm-hmm. But it could happen, and you can sense Lebanon slipping quite slowly, but slipping into the sort of turmoil of the Syrian civil war.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, 3 years ago, at the dawn of the so-called Arab Spring, when I talked to you then, you said, well, hold your horses because, well, that's my paraphrase.
Sure.
Just wait a minute because this is going to be a long, hard fight, and nobody really knows what they're doing, and there are a lot of opposing sides and allied sides and a lot of tough rows to hoe, basically. A lot of turmoil before we see the rights of man take hold in the Middle East as a governing philosophy.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that I'm afraid that's turned out to be all too correct, you know. I think a lot of media was pretty, foreign media was pretty naive in thinking that this was going to be a new sort of velvet revolution, like sort of Czechoslovakia and whenever it was, 1989. You know, now we have sort of Egypt, Libya, anarchy, Egypt, the army back in control, having shot about 1,000 people. You know, in most of these countries, things are worse than they were. But maybe, you know, the story isn't over yet. Revolutions have long periods when they seem to go backwards, suddenly they go forwards again. Mm-hmm. But just at this moment, the situation doesn't look too good.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, and I don't want to build it up too much, but it seems like the possible nuclear deal with Iran could really be a big thing. And I saw where the Saudi king said something along the lines, or, you know, the foreign minister said, you know, yeah, maybe that would be all right. And it seems like that could really be perhaps a possible first step toward nipping the Sunni Shia Arab civil war in the bud, rather than just, you know, seeing this go on as a proxy war between Saudi and Iran from now on.
Yeah, I think the Saudis, on the one hand, their main sort of priority is opposing Iran. On the other hand, they think we can do a deal, you know. I never quite understood why they're so worried about the Shia and the Iran, because, you know, the Shia can really only be a factor where there are, in countries where there are a lot of Shia, and there are only about four of them. Almost all the Muslim countries in the world are heavily, you know, Sunni, 90% of the Muslims, about 1.6 billion in the world, 90% of them are Sunni, and the Shia aren't going to make any headway in countries where they're dominant.
Right. Yeah, the Saudis don't have too much to lose, I don't think either. All right, well, thanks very much for your time. It's great to talk to you as always, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you. Bye.
All right, everybody, that's the great Patrick Coburn, author of Muqtada and foreign correspondent, Middle East correspondent for theindependent.co.uk. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for tuning in. I got a couple of friends in the chat room trying to help me find my footnote. You know what I think it is? I think that I learned that, my little factoid, in the movie The Gatekeepers. In that movie, have you ever seen The Gatekeepers? Just go to scotthorton.org/documentaries. scotthorton.org/documentaries. And you will see the embedded video there for The Gatekeepers, part one and part two, with subtitles. And what it is it's all interviews with the former leaders, the former directors of the Shin Bet, Israeli internal security, and internal in the sense of, you know, the West Bank being part of Israel. You could call them the secret police of the foreign occupying force in the West Bank. Something like that, if you want it to be a little bit more accurate. Well, and I guess inside regular Israel, too. Both. But anyway. So, it's all leaders of the Shin Bet. And it must have been... Man, I hope I don't have to sit and watch that whole movie again. Wish my brain worked better. And, you know, maybe after the show... I'll spend some time Googling it myself and see if I can find it. Now, somebody found a thing about putting on a curfew and doing things. I didn't get a chance to read the whole article yet, but Israel Shamir clamping down on the residents of the West Bank during the first Gulf War. But, what I was thinking of was, I believe somebody says Netanyahu was arguing during the first Gulf War. It could have been during the fall of the Soviet Union, but damn. I don't know why I can't choose. It's like a 50-50 split there about which it was. Damn it. But anyway, and then I also can't remember if it was Netanyahu or not, but it must have been Netanyahu was trying to convince everybody else that now's our chance to expel all the Palestinians from the West Bank. And he didn't win on that. He was, you know, they didn't get away with that. They didn't try it. But that was his idea then. And you know what? It's a minor point anyway. It just goes to show, whoever the hell it was one of them of importance. And it was during a crisis that was not directly related to the occupation. But it was just, you know, next time the whole world is busy looking at one thing, maybe we can go ahead and take advantage of that opportunity and expel all the Palestinians from the West Bank. Something like that. Anyway, maybe I'll find it for you. Maybe I won't. I'm always right. I just don't always have my footnote. And sometimes I'm wrong. But not usually. All right. That Iraq invasion back 2003, shouldn't have done that. I tried to tell you not to do that. And I wasn't the best of all of the best arguments, and I wasn't writing articles about it. I was on the radio trying to tell you not to do it. And there were a lot of people before the war, as Ron Paul notes in his article at antiwar.com today. Richard Pearl says, oh, boo-hoo, because we did the right thing we thought at the time, and so you can't go back and second-guess us. And Ron Paul says, oh, yeah, well, a lot of us knew better back then and said so. Now, look what you've done. And, you know, I don't care if the Shiites rule Baghdad. And I don't care if Iran increases a bunch of power because of American stupid foreign policy to put the Shiites in power in Baghdad. Personally, it doesn't matter to me. All I'm saying is, look what you did. You knocked down a gigantic domino. Then knock down 100 others. We don't even know. The world is going to see blowback from the American invasion of Iraq from 2003 from now on. And now, you know, I am kind of optimistic-y when I try to be, if I can, on some days. And you know what? Maybe it was just blowing smoke, but it seemed to me like a possible really big deal. When the Saudi foreign minister was asked about the American nuclear deal with Iran and said, you know what, maybe that'd be all right. Go ahead. I don't know. Why not? Hey, you guys are the superpower. We're your ally. No, he didn't say that. He said, yeah, you know what, maybe that'd be all right. Patrick Coburn says, yeah, what are you afraid of? Saudis? And so now my thing is, boy, I'm such a utopian. My thing is, I think that if the Saudi government and the Iranian government are seeing eye to eye, I don't know, say on some business deals, some mutual security arrangements in the Gulf to prevent piracy and stuff like that, and, you know, whatever, they have a normal nation-state neighbor-type relationship instead of this whole stupid Cold War. If that happens, then they could work together to call off what is shaping up to be a sectarian Sunni versus Shia civil war in the Arab world right now, with the Shia backed by Iran and the Sunnis backed by the Saudis. And by the way, doesn't that kind of bother you a little? When you know how much the Saudis have been paying for all these jihadis all this time? Which side were they on in the American war in Iraq? When America was fighting for the Iranian side, the Americans were being attacked the whole time by the Saudi side. The Saudis are allies while we're fighting for our enemies. That's stupid Washington, D.C. I say put it on an ice floe and put it out like an Eskimo grandma and just, we're tired of taking care of your complaining ass. We're done with you, capital city. Just, couldn't you just somehow just break it off? Look what they've done. Look what they did over there. And you know, Coburn, man, he's the guy that wrote the book. The book is Muqtada. That was, remember the cell phone footage of Saddam Hussein's lynching? And in the background, you can hear him going, Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. Yeah, that was Muqtada al-Sadr. He's the kingmaker now. He's the catbird seat occupier now. The most powerful member, well, I guess other than the prime minister, the most powerful member of the United Iraqi Alliance, and probable one day Ayatollah of Iraq. Yeah, you never know. But certainly, the point being that now's his time. Not that he'll necessarily take full advantage of it, but he seems to be, so far. But now, the Shiites control the capital city. Geography-wise, it's at 85% Shiite Arab city now. And they control the government, and they're the majority of the country, so they always will control the government. The United Iraqi Alliance will never lose, ever. They don't even need the Sunnis. They don't have to provoke them into boycotting the election or anything. They're still going to always win. They've got huge majorities on their side. And especially if they can bring the Kurds into the coalition, which they have all this time so far, since 04 or 05, when they're writing the Constitution and first electing the parliament there. And so what this means is that's the huge domino. When the Americans invaded and brought the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, the Bada Brigade, into Iraq on their heels, they turned that country from a Sunni dictatorship, minority dictatorship, into a majority Shiite dictatorship. You know, supposed democracy, but whatever. I mean, in a very literal sense, hey, majority rules, right? So there you go. But anyway, so what that means is, one, people used to have power are way on the outs and very mad about it. And two, on a regional basis, British and French drawn borders notwithstanding, the losers in Iraq are the rulers region-wide. And so, hey, why not start that war back up again? It's not like Maliki will give him an inch, you know? He won't, or that's not the right turn of phrase. But anyway, Maliki won't do a damn thing for the Sunnis except arrest their leaders and clamp down on them. And so, it's not like they have a thing to gain from participating in Iraqi democracy. So, I don't know. I think that it sounds kind of crazy. He started answering me before I was quite done answering my question. I was going to ask him, hypothetically, I asked you before and you said, nah, probably not. But now, what do you think? Is there going to be a new Sunni Arab Islamist state between Syria, the Sunni rebel-held parts of Syria and Iraq? I guess he started saying, well, the Assad's, you know, really got momentum now that the rebels are fighting each other. Maybe we'll be able to take that part of the country back. But anyway, that's a possibility, is that straight line, that, I forgot, it's not the Durand line. I don't know if they have a name for it. The Sykes-Picot line there between Syria and Iraq. There may be no such thing as that anymore. I mean, Iraq already had Kurdistan as a de facto independent. And the Islamic State of Iraq declared independence the other day. I don't know if they can keep it. Now, it used to be a fight between the Sadrists and the Supreme Islamic Council about whether they'd be willing to let the Sunni part of Iraq go. I think Sadr, for a time at least, wanted an alliance, not just to dominate the Sunni part of Iraq, the Anbar province and the Sunni triangle and all that, but to have an alliance with them, some kind of accommodation, and form a coalition government that would be opposed to the Iranian and American influence in the country. But that never went anywhere. And so really, the Supreme Islamic Council, they were favored by the Iranians and the Americans. The Americans, I don't know why, just because I guess they were rich guys among the Shiites. Who are they going to deal with? Sadr, who is scum to them. So they're dealing with Abdulaziz al-Hakim, but he was also the favorite of the Iranians because what he wanted was for there to be federalism as opposed to nationalism. And in other words, break off southern Iraq and make it, you know, Shiiteistan or whatever the hell, in alliance with Iran there. And, you know, they can still call it Iraq, but it'll be a de facto independent Shiite Iraq, and then conveniently including Baghdad now because of the American effort there. You know, back in the last Iran-Iraq war, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan were using Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. Well, this time, and they never had the capacity to really invade Iraq, this time America invaded Iraq for them and gave them the whole South, at least to their allies. The former vice president's boy. Isn't that funny? Anyway. Never mind. Yeah, and Dick Cheney and Colin Powell. I mean, the very same characters on both sides of that one, like always. And of course, they were back in the Ayatollah. They were back at the same time they were back in Saddam back in the 80s, too. So you never know with these guys. But anyway, I don't think it has to be a civil war, but it's shaping up to be one over there. America's invasion was just the start. Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonx.org/liberty. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org/chat. If you want to hang out in the chat room during the show. Good to see everybody back after the new year. May have lost some listeners. May have gained some. I don't know, but I'm happy to have y'all tuned in to the show today. Well, I don't know. I'm still trying to decide what to talk about. I guess I want to talk about Snowden and NSA stuff more. It's come to my attention that, well, I don't know. At least the media would have us believe. I don't know. I guess the polls say a lot of Americans, they don't like Snowden. I don't know exactly what the percentages are. But they think Snowden did the wrong thing by liberating all the secrets and giving them to them. I mean, how brainwashed from toddlerhood do you gotta be to be so wrong about life? I mean, whatever. If you work for the Department of Homeland Security, you know, collecting checks or whatever it is that you do there, oppressing people when you get the opportunity, then, of course, you think that. But I'm talking to actual human beings. If you're not power, how in the hell do you choose to identify with power over identifying with your own self? Edward Snowden said to Barton Gellman at the Washington Post, "Look, man, I didn't give anything to the Russians or the Chinese. I didn't defect. It was Obama took my passport from me, quite illegally, and left me stranded in Russia. I didn't defect to Russia. He left me stranded here. If I defected, I defected from the government to the people. That's what he said. The people. That's you. And somehow TV has got Americans, and I guess radio too, and maybe their own, you know, I don't know, churches, families, schools, upbringings. American society upholds the right of the government to keep secrets from us as some really high paramount thing, you know? Oh, it's just terrible that this guy told us what the state is up to. And this is at a time where supermajorities are saying the biggest threat to life and liberty in America is big government, is the national government. 73% or something said that. A supermajority. In the recent Gallup poll, said that it's big government that is the threat to our life and liberty. Yeah, it's about time. Of course, that number will plummet as soon as Jeb Bush comes. But anyway, as long as the Democrats are in there, conservatives like to pretend to believe in liberty for a minute. It sounds better, you know. But still, huge percentages of people distrust the government, see it as a problem. I don't know, what, a good 15, 20 points of that has got to be directly because of Edward Snowden and his revelations, right? That, yeah, no, really, every kooky thing that you could have imagined about how they're hacking you, yeah, they're hacking you. They're hacking the firmware on your hard drive. They're hacking the camera and the microphone on the phone in your pocket. They're hacking your location all day long. All of you. And all your keywords, too. And so, and then somehow people don't like Ed Snowden. This guy is the greatest American hero ever. Are you kidding me? And, you know, there's a lady over there at the New Yorker, Amy Davidson, pointed out she was poking numerous holes in a piece by Fred Kaplan, trying to make it sound like Edward Snowden was a bad guy. And she was completely debunking his ridiculous article. But part of her debunking was pointing out the simple fact. Everyone's saying, oh, he broke his oath, he broke his oath. That is 100% not true. In fact, it is the exact opposite of the truth. He upheld his oath. All these guys are, you know, Emperor Wears No Clothes right now in panic. He upheld his oath. He had to violate his measly secrecy agreement, his confidentiality agreement. He had to sign a thing that said, I agree. And you're telling me that that's swearing an oath before God? That trumps his actual oath? To the Constitution, which includes the Fourth Amendment, which is an amendment. Which means it, you know, theoretically, trumps any power granted to the national government in Articles 1 through 6 or 7 or whatever the hell it is. It's an amendment. It says, oh yeah, everything else that's already in there about what powers you do have notwithstanding, you cannot search anybody unless you show to a judge why you already have probable cause to believe you'll find evidence of a crime. Otherwise, beat it. That's the rules. That's what makes America, America, see? And so Edward Snowden had access to all of this, what they're up to, and he decided, yeah, he took it upon himself, oh, boo-hoo for you, to do the right thing and tell the American people what their government is doing to them. And to other people around the world, too, to explain the all-pervasive vacuuming up of data by the National Security Agency. Your complete kook friend was completely right about how far they've gone. In fact, I would ask you to go to EFF.org. In fact, search EFF.org NSA. And you'll see the headline is primary sources. But it's primary sources and it's all the news articles where each of these documents were first reported. And secondarily reported if there's overlap, too. And it's really good. It's the best timeline that Al Jazeera, America, America.aljazeera.com. If you just type in Al Jazeera NSA files or NSA timeline, you'll find that. They've both done, EFF.org and Al Jazeera have both done a great job of compiling all the different NSA stories from all the different sources around the world for you there. And anyway, so I don't know, man. I just wanted to push back a little bit in because I thought it went without saying that this guy, Ed Snowden's a hero. Everybody agrees about that. But then, no, man, you know what? You cannot underestimate the power of the media. And if Brian Williams and Jeffrey Toobin and whatever goofballs from cable TV news, if they all agree that, oh my goodness, well, what if just every NSA contractor leaked whatever he wanted, then it starts to sound like that's the consensus. In fact, it was Jake Tapper from CNN. He's the guy I'll pick on now. I brought this up before, but I think it's important. Jake Tapper was doing this to Bradley Manning. Of course, they all did the very same thing to Bradley Manning or Chelsea Manning. And what he did was he said about Snowden, he was actually trying to cut Snowden a little bit of slack. And what he did was he said, well, now, look, it's agreed. Maybe he said it's widely agreed that what Chelsea Manning did was wrong, was beyond the pale to do. But that maybe this Edward Snowden guy's a whistleblower. What about that? That was his question for his guest, whoever his guest was. But that was how he framed the question. Now, he never said who it's widely agreed by, the people at his dinner party or whatever. What does that matter? Is it widely agreed by the American people? Is that the consensus of the American people that we all disapprove of Chelsea Manning's liberation of the Iraq and Afghan warlocks and the State Department cables? We all believe that the worst criminals in the world have the right to keep their secrets about the crimes that they commit upon the innocent inhabitants of this earth, and the guilty ones too. You might have noticed that America's got an illegitimate evil empire ruling the planet. Not that they're legitimate empires, but you understand, I'm just trying to smear the thing bad. It's an empire. It's a brutal, murderous empire. And the secrets that Chelsea Manning released are the antidote to that. Not that it's the cure-all in one shot, but hey, the Iraq and Afghan warlogs and the State Department cables, there's 10,000 articles of extremely important journalism has come out of those documents. Cannot be argued that that's not a whistleblower. And in fact, you know, the kooks and the critics, the critics on the kook side were saying, well, it's a limited hangout because where's all the top secretist dirt about Israel or whatever like that? Well, Chelsea Manning explained at the trial that, hey, listen, I deliberately, I had access to much higher level secrets. But I deliberately chose only the secret and confidential level stuff on the CipherNet, and I forgot the other one, because I didn't want to compromise sources and methods. I didn't want to be a traitor. I didn't want to get American soldiers, put them in jeopardy where they would get in, you know, in violent situations because of me or whatever. But I thought this is a great way to split the difference. I can actually get a bunch of secrets out, things that shouldn't be secret. Things that will inform the public, where they will be better able to decide, without actually hurting anyone. So that made the kooks and the government's accusations against Chelsea Manning pretty moot, if you ask me. And of course, the Secretary of Defense admitted that none of his men were killed, not one was killed. None of his Quislings, none of their sock puppet informants or translators or anybody in Afghanistan or Iraq or anybody was held to account because they were exposed in those WikiLeaks. Not one. Now, how many times do you hear, especially on conservative talk radio, did you hear people talking about blood on his hands, blood on his hands, Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, blood on their hands, blood on their hands. Nope. Blood on the hands of the State Department and the Defense Department. You know, the worst liars and murderers on the face of the earth. Blood on their hands, exposed by the hero. But instead, what's Jake Tapper do? Oh, well, everybody agrees we don't like Chelsea Manning. And that's the only way you can get him to throw a bone to Ed Snowden. But maybe Ed Snowden, there's a little bit, I don't know. Well, what's the difference? That's what Kevin Gostala asked in his piece about the New York Times. Recommending a pardon for Snowden. Hey, what about Chelsea Manning and the brig over here? All right, thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.